I, for one, am truly impressed if he could keep it that short at a business meeting. We're all friends here. And this morning, we have for our speaker, Sharon B. from Los Angeles, California.
Good morning. My name is Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic. And I think you can probably all hear me. I have a tendency to be a little loud, but I had breakfast with my friend Van Noy, who's going to be your Al-Anon speaker this morning. And compared to Van Noy, I'm not loud. So I love her, so I can say that. It was great having breakfast with her because I didn't really have to think. I could listen. I mean all of this lovingly, you know it, don't you, Vanna? She does get the microphone last, so I better be nice. I enjoyed Ed's snowplow method of living. I like that. I visualize a lot in my life, and the head's not as insane as it used to be. I don't listen to it very much, but I have a lot of visualizations, and it's fun. It's entertaining, and a lot of my higher power, my early higher power, was based on things I could see visually because I couldn't feel anything. I was real numb when I got here, but I'm not numb today, and I'm the child of God today, and I know that I'm on the right path, and I'm right where I'm supposed to be, and it's with you this morning. And I was looking around at all of our bright faces and bright eyes, and people weren't shaking when they were holding coffee cups, and you know, I could sit down and have breakfast. I mean, that's a miracle. On a Saturday morning, and I like to remember those things because, you know, no matter what life doles out, whatever comes my way, and whether it's my turn or not, if I stay sober through it, my experience will benefit others. And I like to know that somewhere all of this means something. I'm a curious drunk. I've always been a curious drunk, so I like to kind of hang in there when I'm thrown in the swamp of alligators because I want to know when I get to the next side why I was in the swamp, you know, getting bit up, so... But it's nice to be here with all of you. I would like to thank Milt and Patty and all of you for having me here. And a little special thank you to my little benefactor for my T-shirt. Somebody was doing something nice for someone without getting found out this morning, and I would like to let that person know I'll wear it. I'll wear it to play volleyball at Clancy's Yard, so that's where I'll wear your T-shirt. And paying for my curse words, that's what we do there. Because of Charlotte, his wife. And we like to clean up our mouth. But... it's funny how much money you can spend without thinking about it. and there's a sliding scale. It's great. You know, there's really $2 words. When you're having a $2 word day, you know that you better go home and start cracking the book and get on your knees. But so that's where I would be this morning if I wasn't with you. I'd be playing volleyball with some other sober women, and the children would be running around and putting ropes in trees and having a good time, and the men would be playing softball, and then we'd have a little barbecue, and then there would be another volleyball game, and we'd kind of go our way until a meeting at night. And I'm a part of a family. I am part of a family of understanding. I have a family of blood, and none of that family is an alcoholic. They don't suffer from the disease of alcoholism unless it's being next to mine. That's the only dysfunctional part of my family is me. You know, I'll tell you that. If they had any problems, it was me, and they all still are very normal and wonderful people. And my parents still live in the same house that I grew up in Iowa, and... I just went home for their 50th anniversary, and I mean, how normal they are is they moved the house. I mean, they moved the whole house a while down the road, and I have two normal sisters and a normal brother, and they're just fine. And there was always something a bit odd about me, and there still is something a bit odd about me, but they find it a little more entertaining now that I'm sober. It's my mother doesn't have to put my addresses in pencil anymore in her book. I've lived in the same place for 11 years. I've been sober 16 years, 1 month, and is it the 27th? 28th? 8 days. And it's a day at a time. My comfort, my serenity, how I feel within my own skin is based upon what I do today to be as Nancy said, of service to myself and my God and my program. And... you know, what I do today is important, so thank you for the opportunity for me to be able to be of service today. I told you I grew up in Iowa, and that was my first resentment, totally. And it took me a while to make peace with that. But when I was out drinking in the bars, I was not from Iowa. I picked states at least like Wisconsin because they had cheese, you know. And Iowa had pigs and corn. And it's because I felt like a pig. I mean, I drank like a pig. I started drinking at 13 years old, and there was a transformation in my life that I fell in love. I fell in love with the effect of alcohol. It turned me into, you know, from a skinny, knock-kneed, guilt-ridden, short-haired, always felt gawky little girl into Marilyn Monroe, you know, in the course of just a couple of hits of that Canadian club and one Schlitz beer. I slid off the top of that 57 Chevy, and my legs got a little more curvy, and my bumps got a little bigger, and I could dance with those football boys, and I could drive them all home, and didn't know I even knew how to drive. Life began for me. Alcohol was a lot of courage for me. It was instant courage. Alcohol gave me a lot of... Alcohol allowed me to live life. I was always very sensitive, overly sensitive, and I learned how to mask my feelings early on because people thought I was weird. And I learned how to get along. I learned how to all the social skills, and I learned how to be such an overachiever that you couldn't really pinpoint who I was. You know, I had so much going on that I didn't have to really appear, you know. And as I went through high school, my drinking was a little bit of a problem. I had a little bit of an attitude problem. I got brought home by the police a couple of times, but nothing very major. And, you know, it wasn't a problem. It was just, you know, Sharon just out... learning how to, I guess, just, you know, just trying some new things. And as I went off to college, it totally flourished. As soon as I got up from under the wing of my family and got in this Big Ten university where there were 30,000-plus people, boy, this big fish in a little pond went to a little fish in a huge pond. And I felt odd and awkward again. And I had started to smoke pot because it was there. I am a product of the late 60s, and I think anybody who grew up in that time frame, you know, swigged down a lot of pills and smoked a lot of pot with their alcohol. But I know today I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I just kind of went through all that stuff and always went to alcohol. And I had a fake ID, and I drank in the bars, and I joined a sorority, and I tried to fit in. I wanted to be an education art teacher. I wanted to do that. I kind of had some goals. I was pinned to this guy. We were going to get married. I caught him with his tutor one night, and I just... ended that, and I got drunk at him, and I pulled a shade on the feelings. I'm a shade puller, you know. I just pulled shades on feelings because I didn't want to feel it so intensely, and it hurt too much. And so I would get drunk and just pull the shade on the feelings. And Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, with sponsorship and working steps, we've learned how to, like, just take the edge of that shade and flip it up so it just kind of opens you all up, you know. But I pulled a lot of shades on my house in life, and that was one of them, you know. And I started to get discouraged with what everybody seemed to want me to do, what I thought everybody seemed to want me to do, you know. And I had a suicide attempt. My father came down with the priest to the school I was going to, and we went out to dinner, and the priest and I got very, very drunk that night. And I was beginning to become very rebellious. I was beginning to show up at protest rallies and peace marches, and I would, you know, hang out with the Black Panther cult, or I would go with the SDS group. I never really belonged to any of those, you know, but I would hang out because they were exciting, and there was a lot going on, and they were angry. And I liked that because I'm starting to get angry. I kind of dropped out of the education mode. I dropped out of the sorority, and I just kind of fell into the strangeness happening around that campus. And I started to paint Jackson Pollock-type paintings on canvas on the ground as I would roll in it. I mean, I would paint myself and roll and create, you know. And I was high a lot of the time. And my father would come down to bring me groceries and out because I was beginning to look a little strange and thin. And, you know, he would catch me cleaning my pound of pot on the table, you know, instead of being in class. And my dad and I got into a huge fight, and we both said some things that we wish we could have taken back as soon as we said them. And it was the beginning of the separation of me and my father. And that hurt me deeply. And I didn't know that because I pulled a shade on it, you know. I drank at it, and I covered up those feelings. And I ended up leaving college because it just got too hot. Everything got a little too crazy, and I went to New York City to try to work And I got a job at an ad agency, and I worked in the Pan Am building, and I lived uptown by Columbia University. And I put on my nice clothing, and I went off to work, and then I met the crowd that was the rebellious bunch. And so I would wear this nice clothing and do my job and drink. We would go out and drink for about 2 hours at lunchtime, and then we would come back and try to work. And we would come in with hangovers in the morning, but everybody there drank, so we all kind of protected one another. But I would have this other cult of people I hung with, and they were into truth, you know, and boy, I was on that search, you know. It was out there somewhere, and so we were taking I had a bag of LSD that summer of powdered orange sunshine, and every morning I would lick my fingers and stick it in the bag and lick my fingers, you know, and go off to work, and I started to get real strange, you know, and you could see truth kind of written in the subway, you know, there it would be there, you know, under the neon lights, and you'd catch it out of the corner of your eye, and it'd be gone, you know, and it would come to us as we were sitting there listening to music, and we'd write it down, and then the next day we'd have reams of paper, and we couldn't find, where's that one sentence that made sense, where was truth, you know, and it was just so elusive for me. I always thought it was out there, you know, and it was always, the grass was always greener. I wanted what you had. You had something I couldn't get. I didn't know it was an inside job. I did not know that God is within, and the truth is knowing my God. I had no idea of that. I just thought it was, you know, in this next 16 hits of acid I was going to take, or, you know, in this next bunch of people I would bring home from Central Park into my living room so we could have the jam session, you know, and the next Scientologist I could meet and talk to, I got a little crazy. I got a little paranoid. I was doing a lot of uppers because I didn't want to sleep. Bless you. I was looking for, truth on a 24-hour basis, and I didn't want to sleep because I thought I'd miss it, you know. And so I was always going, and I had anxiety attacks, and I got a little crazy, and I called my dad, and I said, you know what, Dad, this isn't working. I think I want to go back to college, and I had to do some good talking. We're good con people, boy. And, Dad bought it. And so he paid for another semester of college, and there I was back at that Big Ten University. And when I got back there were some changes that had happened. I didn't seem that excited about all these protest things. I didn't care about all that anymore. I was taking these art classes, and I could not sit down and create anything unless it was chemically induced. My creativity had just run out my sleeve somewhere, and that depressed me terribly because I used to be so creative, and I could make people happy with what I drew, and that was gone. And I was just depressed. I had this cat, Raja, my cat, and he was a stoned-out cat because he was born in New York with everything happening, and so my cat and Raja and I just stayed depressed that whole spring, And my father came down, and we had another fight. It was another bad fight. And I ended up moving to Colorado. You know, my bags were packed, and I was gone, and that was it. You know, Dad was not going to fall for this game anymore. And I moved to Colorado because, I don't know, I had read a Western novel, and I thought that might fix it. So I did not know I was on the run. You know, I did not know I was one of those people that took geographics and that. I thought I left me back there. You know, the part of me I didn't like, the part of my life I didn't like, I thought I left it back there. Whenever I moved somewhere, I thought I left it back there. And my cry was always, I'm not hurting anybody but myself. You know, and that's a very self-centered, selfish little cry. And you get to Alcoholics Anonymous and you work the 12 steps. And especially after you work 4, 5, 6, and 7, are you able to see the damage you cause. And I was not able to see or know any of that. I always felt judged by my parents. I always felt judged by those people that seemed to have it all together, that boring life that they all had, that I was not going to have a two-car garage and a ranch-style home and 3.2 kids. I was not going to do that. And I just knew I couldn't. That's why. I just knew I couldn't. And I ended up in Colorado where the grass was greener, you know. It always was greener. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a speaker called Norm Alpe, named Norm Alpe, who's no longer with us. But I loved Norm. He would pump me up and just get me going. And he told me why the grass was always greener. He said, Sharon, it's because the other guy took care of his lawn, you know. And that's, you know, I always wanted to go lie on your dichondra, you know. And now I've learned how to take care of my lawn. You know what grows real well is you need a little bit of fertilizer, and I had plenty of that to get my lawn going. So we have a lawn of dichondra today, and we've learned how to take care of our own lawn. But that's the way it was, you know, and I'm working with these equestrian people, and I wasn't too bad. I wasn't drinking too many times and taking home too many different husbands and that kind of thing. So I was behaving myself, I thought. And I was working at this restaurant, and in walks Bob Dylan. You know, it was near Aspen. It could have been him. It looks like Bob Dylan. Maybe it's him, you know. And this guy ordered a chocolate milkshake, you know, and I thought, God, this is Bob Dylan. What am I going to do? And, you know, he's my hero. And so I made two chocolate milkshakes to go, and I came in and I got in the car with this guy. I said, where are we going? He said, oh. I said, I'm coming with you. And he said, we're going to California. And I said, okay. And that was the best I could do that day, you know. Little did I had no idea when I got up in the morning that I was going to be on the way to California with Bob Dylan. You know, and I'm not really sure who he was, but he was very spiritual. And we ended up in Huntington Beach, and he went his way, I went mine. I ended up at a commune in Huntington Beach where I think one person was on welfare, and we all lived on that. And we had a lot of soup and a lot of pot. And when we cleaned that pot, boy, we didn't throw away anything. We put the seeds in our crunchy granola and the stems in our chicken cacciatore, you know. And we even drank the wine from the bong. I mean, you know, we just didn't waste anything, you know. And we had cats and dogs and all of us. And I have this picture. I don't know how it survived. It's all kind of ripped up and torn, but it's this picture of all of us that we took, you know. And everybody's at half-mast, including the cats and the dogs. Everybody's at half-mast. But it was a lot of fun. I came with $2. I left with $4 and a dog 4 months later. I made a profit, you know. I had a great time. And I turned 21 out here in Westwood, California. Panhandled for my wine. I mean, that's what we did. They would teach me to panhandle, and I was not good at that. I was just... You have no self-worth. It's hard to be a panhandler, you know. You don't want to give me a quarter, do you? I mean, it doesn't work. Absolutely doesn't work. But I showed this guy my license. I said, it's my 21st birthday, look. And he bought me a couple of bottles of wine, you know. And so I went and I drank it. And then I saw the Krishnas across the street. They always would dance in front of the Bank of America building. You know, and all my SDS friends always wanted to blow up that Bank of America building, you know. And so that was torn between wanting to go dance with the Krishnas and blow up the Bank of America building. But as the wine started to work, I kind of liked their music, you know. I kind of liked their jingle. And the words aren't too hard to follow along, you know. So I found myself over there with them, you know. And there I was. You know, on my 21st birthday, and they thought this was a karmic happening, you know, and it was just, there was something about me always. I mean, whether I was with the Scientologists or the Pentecostal Holy Rollers or anybody, they could just spot my brown aura. You know, I had this big hole in my psyche, and they could just see it, and they thought, this one needs help. And I remember the Jesus Freaks in Laguna, where they pulled me right on in, you know, and I needed, they had a spark that I needed. I knew there was something I needed, but these people would talk about eternity and forever. And those two words did not fit at all in my life. And anytime anybody talked about those two words, I was out of there because I didn't do anything forever. I did not do anything for an eternity. That was one of the reasons I was never going to get married, was it just seemed like forever. And when they started to talk about this stuff and this eternity stuff, and I said, I'll see you guys, because I just didn't, you know, if I couldn't put it in my backpack, I didn't want to own it. That's the way I lived my life. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You said it was a day at a time. And I kept, you know, I had that yeah, but in my mind. When's that other shoe going to drop? You know, when are they going to tell me this is forever? You know, you don't do sobriety 5, 10, 15, 16 years, 1 week and 1 month and 8 days at a crack. You do it a day at a time. And I understand that. You know, that was the biggest hook for me coming here, was no, it's just today. And I had absolutely just no idea that it was going to be a lot of days at a time that I'd be able to stand here, you know, on the 28th of September with some time put together. But I've done it. I did it today. If I don't live my life well today, I don't know. It's not going to be a good build-up for tomorrow. I like comfort today. I'm not the kind of person that can live in turmoil for a long period of time. You know, I like comfort today. It's not about being good and bad. It's not a moral issue. It's about comfort for me. And if I can do something today to make myself comfortable so that I can live in my own skin and be with God's kids, that's what I want to do. But these people talked about eternity, and I ran screaming from them. And I ended up back in Colorado, going back to my house to get things. I went to move back in, and my landlady had rented it from me. You know, she was my wine drinking friend. I don't know why she did that. And she had rented it, and there were these people living there, and the man that answered the door had my favorite enamel coffee cup in his hand. He was wearing my dashiki. You know, they were sleeping on my sheets. They were cooking with my utensils. And I said, excuse me, I used to live here. I think there's a box of photographs in the corner that I'd like back. And so I walked over, and I picked up this box of photographs, and the guy closed the door on me, and I walked 2 feet from that house, and I thought, what is wrong with you? Those are your things in there. Why didn't you go back and get them? And I couldn't do it. I did not have enough worth to go back and knock on the door and say, excuse me, I want these things back. And I thought, it made me feel awful. It made me feel like a worm. It made me feel like something that was spineless and not human. And I couldn't turn my feet around and go back and knock on that door. I had started to get physically very ill, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. And it progressed, and it got worse. And I ended up living with my mother and father that year, that winter. And I was 21 years old, and my life was over, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I knew I was dying because something was physically very wrong with me. My head was always wrong with me. I knew that. But now all of a sudden, my spirit felt really tired. You know, and they took me to the family doctor, and the doctor gave me Valium because he knew I was living at home with my father, and he knew the history, and he knew it was a bad situation, so they gave me a lot of Valium. And my mother said I could live there that winter as long as I didn't get in my father's way and get in his face. And every time I saw my dad, it was like we averted our eyes, and we just kind of passed in the hall. You know, it was just like if we didn't touch one another, it was too painful. And I stayed in my room most of the day, and I would go out and drink in the taverns at night. My mother said, please don't take any drugs in this house. But it was okay to drink. And nobody knew alcoholism. That family doctor didn't know alcoholism. I had a gallbladder that was non-functional, and I had pancreatitis, and I was very ill, and they thought it was my nerves. So that's what was going on. And I was in the taverns every night, sitting down there, maudlin and judgmental, and I would look at Billy Lang come in, and you know, I thought, I always knew he'd be a loser. He's in this tavern every night. I'm in the tavern every night, you know. And I met a guy that I'd gone to high school with, and he looked different. He said, you know, like, I'll take care of you. We'll get you feeling better, and let's come with me. And I was ready for a change because my only friend had died, and that was my dog. I'd gotten killed by a car that winter, and it was in the trunk of my car frozen all winter long, you know. Poor tar baby. I'd get drunk and talk to her, you know. And by the time April came, my mother dug a hole as fast as she could when it thawed, you know. She was sick of that dead dog in the trunk of the car, I tell you. But that was my life. This is what I had become, the girl who had all the potential, the one who could light up the room when she walked in, the one who could draw a picture and make everybody happy. You know, the one, I'd taken those tests. I could be whatever I wanted to be when I grew up. But I had no discipline, no God, and no structure in my life. And I drank alcohol. And alcohol worked for me. And now I had become reduced to this drunken woman in the taverns that was physically very ill, could not even speak or look at her own father, and had a dead dog as my best friend. That's what had happened to me. You know, and I didn't know alcoholism, and nobody knew alcoholism. And I went and I moved in with this guy because he wanted to take care of me, and that was just fine. But he was living up in northern Wisconsin on an organic farm. So that's where we went. And I thought I would lay back and he'd take care of me. Well, if you live in that kind of environment, and you heat with wood, and you live the organic life, and you live in an old school house that's non-insulated, you're cold all the time, you have to chop wood to have tea going in the morning, you know, and we had to buzzsaw up all the wood, we made maple syrup, we tapped all these maple trees that winter, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm looking back on this, I'm going, you know, I didn't really have this in mind, I thought he was going to help take care of me, but what he did was he took away my cigarettes, he took away my alcohol, and he gave me organic pot to smoke, you know. So that's what I do from morning to night, you know. I'd wake up, I'd light it, it's hung out of my mouth all day long. And I remember being stuck out in the snow. You'd walk out on the crust of the snow for these buckets that are on the maple trees. And you know, they're empty going out, and then you take the full ones back. And he's 6'8", so he can go through the crust of the snow easily. And I was stuck out there up to my thighs with these two full buckets of maple sap, you know. And I'm thinking, I'm thirsty. What am I doing out here? You know, and this pot was just starting to not cut it anymore. And the night I made a big major decision in my life was the night that he was sitting over there playing his banjo one more night, one more time, you know, learning to play the banjo. And he had this Pete Seeger record that he'd put on. It was How to Play the Banjo with Pete Seeger. I want to find one of those because I just want to burn it up in my oven. There's just some sort of finality to all of that. But you know, he was learning the part. If you know five string, you have this you go bum titty with the banjo, you know, with the five string. And he just couldn't get right. And I'm smoking my pot in this rocking chair, and I'm really going for this rocking chair, you know. And I'm smoking it, and he'd start the record over because he'd miss one of the notes. And the cat's flicking its tail, you know, and the dog is looking at me like, my God, do something, you know. And I mean, we didn't have a TV. I was sitting there reading Mother Earth News or Yul Gibbons or Adele Davis or something. I mean, you know, all that healthy stuff. And I'm flying out of this chair, and I just flew out. I don't know, it just happened. I flew out, I got in the car, I went into town, it was snowing, that we were going to get snowed in again, and I got 2 cheap gallons of wine they had at the general store, and I came home, and I put the wine on the table, and I felt better. I felt better. A couple of glasses later, I thought, why did I wait so long, you know? He's off to bed, his banjo's in the corner, he had seen me drunk and maudlin in those bars, and he knew what I was like, and he didn't like me drunk, so he went to bed. And the cats dance and the dogs dance and the Rolling Stones are on. We're having a great time, you know. I, you know, the cowboy boots are back on and I'm having a good time. And he wakes up, but I don't know, I woke him up about 3, 4 in the morning, you know. And he stood at the doorway and I remember that the look he gave me, you know. And it was a look probably of confusion and maybe a little, you know, hurt and maybe even a little compassion. I don't know. But when somebody looked at me that way, because I'd seen it in my dad's eyes, my sister's eyes. I'd seen that look in my mom's eyes. People that cared about me, the psychiatrists, those people, they kind of gave me that look. And the way I always read it as, look at you. You're not good enough. You're never going to be any good. And you might as well just give it up because you're a loser. That's the way I always read that look. Because I have a disease of perception. I have selective hearing. I'm incapable of being honest with myself. I don't have any sort of a spiritual life going at all. And I wouldn't have known the truth if it would have slapped me in the face. And what he was he was confused about me. But I took it as that look of judgment. And what my head said was, you'll never understand. I don't care if you understand. And alcohol is more fun than you anyway. And I made a choice not to be thirsty again. And I started to drink a lot. And the organic people didn't like me drunk. And they had a meeting one night and they blackballed me. They didn't want me around anymore, and that was fine. And finally, Phil gave up on me, and he moved out. And I was alone with a 50 head of sheep, and I was alone with the horse and the dog and the cat and the half acre of marijuana we had planted. You know, summer had come around, and there was a half acre back there that I went, every day I went back and weeded. And I could drink my wine. I could go into the town 45 miles away and sit at the taverns and put on my boots and have a good time. And sometimes I would have my friend Clarence come over. You know, Clarence would come and bring the booze. And he had his tractor because he had too many DWIs and couldn't drive. So he'd come on his tractor. And he didn't have his teeth in most of the time. But he'd bring the booze and we didn't care. And we'd have a good time. And that was what my summer was like. And I was weeding this pot patch. And it was late August, and I felt the snap of the fall coming, and I had vowed never to be cold again like I was the previous winter. So I decided to make a contact and to harvest this pot and to turn it over and to make some money and get out of town. So for 3 days, me and the horse and the cat and the dog obsessively harvested this pot. You know, I would wrap it in a blanket and come in and put it in the boiling water with a wood stove at the roots and hang it upside down in the machine shed. And this is a half acre I did, you know, day and night. I just did this. And third day, I had it all ready in hefty bags, and I went in to do my dope deal 45 miles into this college town, and we forgot it. Me and the dog left it all back sitting at the farm. We just forgot it. We were a little bit high that day, I guess. And so I turned around, and I was embarrassed, and I felt bad, and I thought, you know, what am I going to do? And 2 blocks away, I saw the lights of a carnival, and I thought, God, I always wanted to be a gypsy. So I went over there, and I got me a job that night, and they had an opening. Isn't that strange? And I fit the bill. And so I ran the shooting gallery, and they taught me how to do this, and I packed up my pot and a few items of clothing, and my dog came with me, and we joined the carnival. And they had the speed, and I had the pot, and they drank hard and heavy in the towns, and you drank while you worked. You could just drink all the time, and I was in seventh heaven. And it was leave the mess behind you. You know, you leave town, you leave the mess behind you. That's what I thought. You know, I had no idea that eventually all of these things were just blocking me from me. All of these things were just wedges between me and any sort of spirit I ever had growing up because the spirit was beginning to darken. And I met him on the road, and I guess that's where you meet them. Is they have a lot of potential, those guys in the carnival. And so I met this guy, and somewhere I called my mother, and I said, you know, you're going to have to go take care of, if you want your furniture back, it's all up at the house in Wisconsin. If you, you know, while you're up there, why don't you find someone to feed those sheep? I don't know what's happening. And maybe the horse is hungry, and my cat, I'd like to have my cat back. And yeah, my mother went and did that, you know. She was very hurt by what I had done. She knew that she was now not knowing this person that was her daughter, because these kind of things I didn't go to quite such an extreme about. I was not quite so cold-blooded with animals and things in my life, and I had become kind of cold-blooded. And my mother was very depressed because she didn't know me anymore. We've talked about this. And she didn't believe that I had done this and joined the carnival. And somewhere along in Louisiana, I'm hitting those small towns, I got too drunk one night and I caused too much of a, I don't know, a commotion on the midway, and we had to leave town suddenly. And so I made the manager of the owner of the show a little bit mad, and so it was a couple of towns later, a couple of spots later, I thought, well, all was forgiven. People were starting to talk to me again, but all wasn't forgiven, because I think somebody called up, you know, the forces that be, and I woke up in the morning, and 6 in the morning in Bogalusa, Louisiana, answered the door, and there was a shotgun in my belly, and they searched the room, and they came in, and there were all of Franklinton Parish's finest there that morning, and they found my stash, and they found I had plenty. I had enough to get me for sale and possession, and they took me off to maximum security, because that's the only place they could take a white girl, I guess. I ended up in a maximum security cell, and my boyfriend, of course, went to jail, and he had pet skunk, and the skunk went to jail, and my dog went to jail. It was quite an ordeal, and the carnival left town, and nobody came by to say goodbye, and I stayed in that jail for 31 days. And during that time frame, something else happened that was a situation where I wish I just could have not been there, because it was so painful. It was like an out-of-body experience. They said I had a visitor, and they took me to this attorney's office, and it was a nice office. And sitting in one of those high-back chairs in front of the attorney's nice desk was my father. And there I am, a mess in handcuffs. My gums had started to recede because I wouldn't eat their grits. I had bleeding gums, and there I was sitting there with my handcuffs next to my dad. And if I could have just, you know, done anything to make my life change, I would have that day. And couldn't do it. But nobody knew the disease of alcoholism. My dad flew home. I couldn't get out until they decided to let me out. When they let me out, I sniffed New Orleans across Lake Pontchartrain, and there I was living in the French Quarter, and I had to get a job, and I was afraid of having to do hard time, and they told me I was going to go to trial, and so I better earn some money, and so I started to dance on Bourbon Street, and I started to drink a lot of Cavassier when I would work there, and so I get on this baby grand piano, and they, you know, platinum blonde wig, fishnet stockings, these little funny little outfits, and these platform shoes. If anybody remembers platform shoes, Jesus. We all have a lot of little broken bones in our feet from falling off platform shoes. But there I was on the baby grand trying to earn some money, you know. And I would get so drunk I'd have to fall against the wall, you know. And I remember getting stuck all the time on this one stupid palm tree that was a prop, you know. And it had staples to hold it up on the wall, but my fishnets would always get stuck in those staples, you know. And sometimes I could kind of jimmy them off, you know, just kind of wiggle them off. But this one night, I couldn't get them off, and it was the Alabama football team was in town. And they wanted a show, you know, and so they're rowdy, and there I am trying to get this off the palm tree, you know, and I said, the heck with it, and I ripped them. You know, and if anybody, if you women know fishnets, they kind of hold you in and make you feel real svelte and nice. But I'm a toxic alcoholic. I can show you a drink I had 2 years prior in a part of my skin somewhere. You know, I'm a toxic alcoholic. And it seemed like my thigh poured out the side of this fishnet, you know. And there I was with this lump off the side of my body trying to dance. And that was a humiliating experience. That's something I'll remember. So as a good alcoholic, I asked for a raise, and they said, sorry, and I became a bartender. Now, I tended bar in some of the nicer places in New Orleans, and I got fired for being drunk on the job because I couldn't not drink. And I started working my way down the circuit. My boyfriend of the carnival, we had a 2-year relationship of true love. You know, I thought black eyes and knife fights were true love. I mean, that's where I had come to. You know, he would give me a fresh black eye, and I would wait for him to pass out from his heroin, and then he'd get one. I mean, that's how courageous I was. But we lived in filth, and my parents came to visit about this time. They had gone to Texas to see somebody, and they thought they'd come over and try to find me because they hadn't heard from me in a while. And they found their daughter living above this biker bar on a tar paper roof apartment, living in filth. The skunk droppings were everywhere. We had a pet snake that was running loose. The dog was there. I had changed dramatically since they had seen me the last time. I had become very bloated and very toxic looking, and I had a new black eye, and this was my new him, and he put the snake in my dad's face and called me 4-letter words in front of my mother. And when they left to go home that day, they left me there. Any resemblance of the daughter they had raised, they left. She was gone. And if I could have gone home with him that day, I was real tired. I was real tired. I was about 23 years old, and I was tired of all of this. I had no idea that I was suffering from a disease. I just knew I was bad, and I just accepted this as my lot in life. I had tried to commit suicide a number of times, but I was always such a chicken. I really was. I was such a chicken. And I was just hoping that eventually the lights were going to go out. And that's what I had become. That's the way I felt about me, and that's the way I felt about living life, was there was no more spark left. And I knew it wouldn't change. If I went home with him, I knew it absolutely wouldn't change. And what happened was the next 2 years, my drinking became more violent. My blackouts became more frequent and longer. I would come to another state driving the wrong way on the freeway with people I didn't know screaming in the car. I remember being somewhere in Florida and coming to with all these shots of tequila lined up, but I'd have to go in the bathroom and take the bottle of Jose Cuervo Gold out of my bag and hit on it behind the closed stall in the bathroom because it was insatiable. I couldn't get enough. And the situations I was running into were not positive situations, let's say. I began to not bathe and not take care of myself at all because that's the way I felt about me, but I didn't know that. I had given up. I had just given up living. My last job in New Orleans was working on Lower Decatur Street in a bar you could smell walking down the street, and they fired me for having a bad attitude. And when I begged for that job back, they didn't want me back. My friend Michael was shot and killed on Mardi Gras Day. He was with me. We were partying. We had just gotten off work. He was a bouncer at Pat O'Brien's, and he had a gun. And Michael knew the police in the quarter, and he had been around a while, and he was showing me his gun, and he was pointing it at people on the street. And I said, oh, come on, Michael, it's Mardi Gras Day. Put your gun away. I mean, that's my reality. He got to my apartment. I guess I was in a brownout or blackout. We were having a party. He was on my balcony shooting at people in the street, and the police were called. And Michael was not a violent person. Michael was in an alcoholic blackout. And Michael was 2 feet away from me when the policeman shot and killed him. And seconds and inches. You know, Norm Alpe would talk about seconds and inches, that we are so lucky to sit in here this morning, to have a seat in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because everybody that needs to be here, believe me, they aren't here. And people that want to be here don't have the gift of sobriety. And it was seconds and inches that we get to be in here. And that day it was seconds and inches for me that my life was hanging on a thread, you know. And I was 2 feet inside that door. And I ended up at my sister's in New York. I ended up running to California with some people. I am on the run so fast now I can't stand to be sober. I can't stand to have anything in my head go. My head is really out to just alienate and just kill me. I can't listen to anything inside of me because it's so negative and tells me what a bad person I am. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I sat in my first conference in Palm Springs, I heard a woman say, "We are not bad people trying to get good here. This is not a moral thing, this disease. We are sick people trying to get well." And she allowed me to stay because she took the bad good thing off. Because if I am good too long, there's just something inside of me that wants to put a rose in my teeth and dance on the table, you know? Just something inside of me, you know? It's just part of my personality, you know? So as I told you before, I shoot for comfort. I shoot for comfort. I had to take bad and good out of my life for a long time and shoot for comfort. But I ended up in California at a bar called Barney's Beanery, and I couldn't get hired anywhere. I was a 10-minute cocktail waitress. They asked me to leave. I'm 170 pounds of bloated mess. I don't know where I'm going to sleep, in whose hallway or whose house. I don't know how I'm going to get the next drink, but it didn't matter, and I always got what I needed to get drunk. And I would sit in this bar, Barney's Beanery, and wonder what I'm doing here. And somebody bought me an airline ticket, and I ended up back in New Orleans. And from New Orleans, I met someone going to Hawaii, and he sobered up, and we were in Barney's Beanery in Southern California, and he saw what he had in tow, and he went his way and left me there. And I thought, what am I doing in this sick bar again? I don't like these people. They have hours in California. Nobody's friendly. I don't have a car. And little did I know, that's where I was to meet my Eskimo and Alcoholics Anonymous. The first time I ever saw Chris, she was so drunk that they had to call her taxi cab, and she was going to an A&A meeting. And she had this big book under her arm, and she wove out the door to a taxi cab. And I remember giving her a toast with my rock glass full of gold, you know? Good for her, going to A&A. And little did I know. Little did I know. And on July 27th, I got asked to go to Palm Springs by a couple guys on a Harley, and I love Harleys, you know? I said, yeah, great. You know, and I got in the back of the Harley, and we got into Palm Springs, and they left me, and I asked them why they left me, and they said, well, you know, it was windy going through the desert. We need a little extra weight in the back tire. And that's... That was my last invitation. I had become the lower companion. So I met two new friends that night that wanted a party. They were the bar boys, and when they got off duty, we went somewhere, and I kind of came to in this apartment, and this guy was kicking me in the mouth, and I thought, what is going on here? And so I started to scream, and they raped me, and I got a concussion, and they broke my jaw in three places and broke my nose and drug me around out in the cement, and, somewhere in the course of the evening, I gave up. Somewhere in the course of the evening, I stopped screaming. Somewhere in the course of the evening, I thought, who cares anyway? I just all gave it up. They took me outside of town, and they rolled me off the side of a road outside of Palm Springs. It was July. It was hot. I was face down, no clothes on, bleeding from my face, and I was out. I was passed out down there at the bottom of this cliff, and I should have baked. I really just should have baked. I should have just been another little blurb in the paper. You know, the hometown would have just had to bury me. But what happened was I heard the car door slam, and I came to. And I heard a voice, and the voice said, get up, I want to live. It was loud enough and strong enough that I paid attention to what it said, and I got up. And I came up the side of this road, went down, I guess I found somebody's condominium. I passed out in a lawn chair by the pool. Another 2 feet, you'd have another speaker, you know, seconds and inches. And the police came, a gardener found me. It was a whole big deal. It was in town, they were not going to let this happen. They caught the guys. I'm laying in the hospital that morning on a gurney. And they're taking me into surgery and happy because I'm a victim, you know. God, I made it, you know. I was really happy because I had been a victim for so long, but now they knew I was a victim, you know. And that voice came back, you know, the voice that blocked everything else out in my head. The voice said, you know, Sharon, these guys didn't do this to you. Your father didn't put you here on this gurney. George broke your heart. The Catholic God, your sister, the Mensa, all of those things I drank at, all that mea culpa, poor me stuff, you did this to you. And I'll tell you, when I heard that, it scared me because I didn't want to hear that because I had absolutely no connection with truth. And that was truth, and I knew it. And I lay in the hospital for 2 weeks, and some really wonderful things happened. My God started to set me up for you because nobody said, let's go start over in Phoenix, Arizona. Nobody said, let me take care of you. Nobody sent me an airline ticket, and nobody sent me any money. And I laid there for 2 weeks. And when I got out, I went and lived with a guy I had met in Barney's Beanery who felt sorry for me, and he lived above a liquor store in West Los Angeles. They caught these guys. I had to go back to doctors. I had to go back to court. I was a mess, and I was really tired. And so when he said, you can come stay with me, I didn't argue. And I went and I stayed with him, and it was hot. It was August. He would go off to work and buy me a gallon of red wine every morning. And I would stick a straw on the top of the red wine and stick a straw through the wires on my face where the tooth had been, and I would suck on that wine all day long. I was on a liquid diet anyway. I couldn't eat, you know. But something had happened. Something had changed. Alcohol, I didn't even care for the taste of it anymore. Alcohol had lost any of its magic. It had done that periodically. I couldn't find the right 5 minutes, you know, to make me feel okay in the drunks I was having. But it had lost it. It had lost its magic. And I didn't know what to do. I just sat there and drank it. And he said I'd have to leave, and so I called my mother. And my mother was in Iowa, and I called her to ask her for some help. And my mother had a panic phone call from some girl that had said something had happened to me that was terrible and kind of told her a little bit about it. And it took my sister 2 days from New York making long-distance phone calls to find out what hospital I was in. And for 2 days, my mother did not know what shape I was in, how bad I was, or where I was. And I'm a mom today. And I'll tell you, I hope I don't get paid back. But my mother can sleep at night today because of you. She doesn't worry when the phone rings in the middle of the night that they've found me somewhere. Thank you, Vanilla. You're not mad at me after all. And my mother said some words to me that we've talked about this too. She doesn't know where she got them because she always sent me some money, even if my dad didn't know about it. But she said to me, you know what, Sharon? I can't help you anymore. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army? And if my mom would have sent $20, you'd have another speaker. Because the next call I made was to a phone number sitting there. It was that girl, Chris, the one I had met in Barney's Beanery with the big book under her arm. And I didn't even relate. I was calling somebody who knew the disease of alcoholism. All I knew was she had always been nice to me. So I called Chris. And Chris said, you know, Sharon, I can't help you, but Suzanne can. And I'm only going to give you her number if you promise to call her. I'm not going to give you her number. And she really kind of pulled me into this thing. And Chris was not sober that day. That's why she didn't come help me. Chris got sober for about 6 months. Chris went back out. Chris came back in and got sober for about 7 months and went back out. Chris came back to another hospital program, got sober for a couple of months, and went back out. The last time I saw Chris was years ago. She was 30 years old. She was in a wheelchair, and there was nobody home in her eyes, and she looked very, very old. There was no Chris left. It was just the disease of alcoholism sitting in that chair. And I can't call Chris on my birthday and tell her thank you. But she knows. She knows. But anyway, she gave me Suzanne's number. And Suzanne was a member of the Pacific Group in Alcoholics Anonymous in Los Angeles. And Suzanne immediately read my mail. I had this broken jaw, so I can't talk. I talk like this. And she said she didn't want to hear me anyway. She wanted to talk. And I thought it was very rude of all of you, really. And Suzanne said, okay, put down your wine and put down your joint. And I thought, how does she know I'm sitting here with both, you know? And I'm going to send two girls over to get you. So I just did what she said. I sat there on the steps of this liquor store, and I waited, and this Volkswagen pulled up. And these two bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, California-looking type girls got out of this Volkswagen and started walking at me. I thought, no, I don't like these girls at all. I don't like them. They don't know anything about me. They're not going to want me around. They're too clean and pretty and nice for me. And they put me in the back of this car, and they took me off to an Echo Park meeting where Nikki was. I'm so glad Nikki's here. Nikki is somebody who saw me get sober, somebody who watched me when I got here, somebody who... Nikki gave me her chips. We didn't have chip meetings when I was new, and Nikki had chips from another meeting, and so she would give me her chips when I had 30 days. She'd take one off her key ring and give me her chip. And I remember, I think it was 90 days, Nikki. She wasn't asking me what my time was. I kind of like go up to her and hope she didn't. She'd always say, well, how much time do you have now, you know? And it's because I would work for that next chip. And she wasn't asking me, you know. I thought, oh, she's forgetting. She doesn't like me anymore. She's probably giving it to somebody else, Pat, who had 8 days less than me. So I went and I stood by her for the longest time at Ohio Street. And finally, you know, she asked me how much time I had. And I think I was like right about 90 days. So we got planned for the next chip. And it meant so much to me to get those chips. And the beauty of it is Nikki and I are both still here. And she's gone through a lot of stuff, and she's a beautiful example of walking through what life doles out with a lot of dignity and grace. And but she was she was like the old-timers that were in that group. They took care of me. I had absolutely no idea what was happening to me. I was brought to this meeting. A man was standing at the door with a tie, and he said, welcome. You know, Nancy talked about that last night, was that there was a feeling of, I can come in here. This man just said I was welcome. Somebody that looked fat and nice had not been that kind to me in a long time. And I came in the room, and it was about half the size. And they put me right in front. You know, it's like the sicker you are, the more they want you to be seen, you know? And, I mean, I had this broken jaw. I had wires all over my face. I had raccoon eyes. I was bruised for the first year I was here. You know, I didn't comb my hair. I had bleach stains in this T-shirt. My jeans were ripped. My huaraches were broken, and I smelled bad. And they wanted me. I didn't get it at all, you know? I had no idea that, you know, that's the sicker you are, the more they wanted you. And they raised my hand, and this man gave me the 20 questions, and I passed with 17. He was so happy. You know, I had no idea what test I was taking, you know. And then I talked about, you know, the speaker talk. I don't remember what he said other than he talked about the spaceship, that he always looked for the spaceship to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. And I thought, God, that's what I did as a kid. I looked for the mothership, you know. And I looked in those Iowa skies as a kid for the mothership. I was obsessed with looking for the mothership. And I never shared that with one other person other than Mary Kroll. Mary Kroll looked at me funny for 2 years after I told her that. You know? So this man was telling like one of my childhood secrets, and I identified. And I don't remember much else what happened other than they said, okay, we're going to drop you off. Don't drink and use between meetings, and we'll pick you up tomorrow night. Don't drink and use in between meetings. That was what they wanted from me. And for some reason, it didn't seem that hard. And their sponsor said, okay, she lives above a liquor store, so you wait till the lights go off before you send her upstairs. So these women would take me home and sit there for an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours with me. And they talk about myself. Nobody asked me about me. And I just didn't do it. I had this little clipping in my pocket. I carried it around for a long time from the Palm Springs paper about this thing, you know, that they'd say, oh, my God, what happened to you? You look terrible. You better go sit in the kitchen till you clean up. It was none of that, you know. They were happy to have me. And so I'd sit there and listen to them talk, and then I would go upstairs, and I would be able to sleep. They gave me a sleeping bag, and they moved me out of the liquor store, and I slept on women's floors for a week at a time. And that's just the way my sobriety began. When I was 30 days sober and I didn't raise my hand anymore, I thought, my God, I'm 30 days sober. I've never done this in my life. I know today was God's grace. You know, the entryway to this house of God, which is within me, was sobriety. Once I got through the porch of staying sober, I could walk into the house and start working the 12 steps. But you have to stay sober. You have to have sobriety to get the 12 steps. And I got the sobriety, and I had absolutely no idea that it was happening to me. It was a real gift of God's grace. It wasn't tough for me in the beginning of not drinking. It wasn't tough at all. Since then, there's been many, many, many times that life has dished out things that I need a drink. I need a drink because I need that relief. But the point is that I haven't done it. And I run to a meeting and I get the relief here. But there's still been moments in my life where I need a drink, but I just don't drink. And I didn't know, but it was easy for me. God wrapped this little cloak of grace around me, and there I was, 30 days sober, sleeping on people's floors, having to go back to court, having to go back to the doctors. First 3 months I was here, I was wired up and I couldn't talk. It was really a blessing. I had to learn to listen. You know, the ears opened up. I had got a sponsor because some guy kept sticking his finger into my chest. There was a lot of peer pressure in my group. It just seemed like they wouldn't let you go very long without getting a sponsor. And so I got a sponsor because I didn't want Michael touching me anymore, you know. So that's why I asked this woman to be my sponsor. And I tell you, I had a spiritual experience because I moved from a floor to a couch just like that. As soon as I got a sponsor, my life got better. And I attached that to something. You know, that was, get a sponsor, your life gets better. And she had me do one thing in her house that I didn't understand, I didn't want to do. She had me get on my knees at night and thank God. And she had me say this little prayer she had write down for me because I couldn't remember it. It was, thank you for all you've given me, thank you for all you've taken away, and thank you for all you've left me. And I had to say that every night. She had to write that down for me so that I could remember it. And I would get at the edge of her couch with a sleeping bag on the couch, and I would feel nothing. But I did that anyway because she asked me to do it for being in her house. And she had me do things like go to 2 meetings a day. I had to walk to the Alano Club. I had to come back, and I would wait, and I would get a ride. She asked me to read 3 pages of the Big Book a day. I couldn't even do that. I didn't track on anything. I was one of those newcomers. I remember a man named Chuck in our group. He was always real kind to me. You know, when I was pretty new, he said, you look tired, kid, you know. He said, normally I tell people to stay for 30 days and take their pack off for 30 days and stay with us, but you look real tired. So why don't you take your pack off and stay with us for 90 days? And it was an invitation. And Chuck was always real, real nice to me. Chuck had told me, yeah, I remember he said, I was somewhere and someone said, do you want to write at tomorrow night's meeting, Sharon? And through my wired teeth, I said, oh, but it's a day at a time. You know, it was like I was so confused with making plans for tomorrow night. He took out his book and he showed me all of his calendar. He said, look, I have a commitment here. Look at next month here and here and here. But how do you feel right now? You know, he'd have to wait 2 minutes, you know, while I thought about that. You know, I had the Rolodex brain that spun around in my head, you know. Finally landed on a card, and I was so creative. All my cards said, fine. You know, every time I asked him, I said, fine. You know, 2 minutes of thinking. He was very patient and very kind with me, you know. And he said, well, that's what we're talking about emotionally. That's all we have to handle is right now. Right now, are you okay? Right now, that's what we mean. But you can go that, tell that person you want to ride to tomorrow night's meeting. It's okay. That's how I was when I was new. And the people in my group were so kind to take the time to teach me, not laugh at my questions. It was so wonderful to be able to ask questions because I was the kind of drunk that knew all the answers. And if I didn't, I didn't want you to know I didn't know all the answers, and I didn't learn a lot. I had been beaten teachable. I was totally teachable. And I asked stupid questions, and I got great answers. And I learned a lot from those old-timers. I met him. I was 6 months, well, he was 6 months sober. I was just after the wires got off. And he had 27 and a half tattoos, and I fell in love. You know, it's just, he had 6 more months than me. He was an old timer. He had done his 4th and 5th step because I read it. You know, I knew all about it. He was working on his defects and his amends, and he was really nice to me. He would do things like send me roses and write me poetry. And I was waitressing at a place called Hobo Joe's. I had to wear this orange uniform, this brown gucky thing, and I had a bad attitude because I wanted to go serve drinks, you know, I wanted to be a bartender, and they didn't want me to do that, and I would work the split shift, I would work the early morning shift, I would work the late at night shift, I didn't know if I was coming or going half the time, and I had a bad attitude, and my sponsor asked me one night, she said, how are your tips going, and I said, rotten, it's a rotten job, it's a rotten life, you know, whine, 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 well, it's the wrong thing to do to the sponsor, I'll tell you, and she said, well, listen, you know, why don't you try to change your attitude? And I said, but you have to be honest in all your affairs. And she said, no. You know, I was telling people how I felt, really, you know. And they come in, they wouldn't want to sit in my station anymore. You know, they want to have, come and listen to me for breakfast, I'll tell you, you know. And my tips were bad. And she said, yeah, and you're supposed to fake it till you feel it. And, you know, they don't care out there how you feel. You go and you suit up and you show up. You just suit up and show up. You leave your mind in the car. Okay, and then they brought the Al-Anon, the Queen Al-Anon of our group over, Sally. And she said, okay, Sally, show her the Al-Anon smile. So they showed... So we worked on that a while. We worked on it, you know, and we got it down. And I thought, you know, these people are really crazy, but I'm going to go out and do everything they say tonight. I had to go work the 11 o'clock shift after that meeting, and I went off armed with something. And I went out there that night, and I would give one of these. I'd say, hi, how are you? And I'd say, I'm just fine. How are you? You know, and I thought, God, they're buying it. It was great. I doubled my tips that night. You know, it was practical experience. They taught me how to live in a world I didn't understand. You know, I go to gas stations and tip the gas station attendant. That was back in the days of full serve for doing my windows. I had no money, but I had no self-worth either. So if you did my windows, I'd give you 50 cents. I'd walk into a store and have to buy something because I breathed your air. I mean, that's just, I had absolutely no worth as a human being, and I didn't know how to get along in the world. Absolutely none. And they taught me how to do this. And my life got better, and I got better jobs. I started to work as a travel agent. I had to go to Mexico a lot. I found out I was afraid to fly. I had absolutely no idea I was afraid to fly. So I was armed with different prayers, getting on the plane, and I'd sit there and I'd chant, okay, we've got to have, I'd always go, fear over faith. No, it's faith over fear, faith over fear. And I chant all the way down, and I have 20 drunken travel agents I have to take down and show the property in Mexico. And I have my big book and my briefcase, and they're all drinking and carrying on, and I have to do all of these negotiations with the hotels, and I just don't know what I'm doing. And I'm just thinking, okay, God, you know, my God had one of those aviation glasses and those hats and the big white scarf, and he'd be out there flying the plane. I'd get on the plane, I'd look in the pilot's eyes, you know, see if they're sober, and it's just, I was just so tired all the time. Anything, I keep both feet on the floor at all times, because you can always feel a difference going on in the plane. Both feet on the floor at all times. Hands ready. I know how many people are between me and each exit, you know. I was flying with Vince Joe the other day, and he's had a fear of flying. And I've really, things have just changed for me incredibly. And I'm reading a magazine, and he's kind of going on and on about this and that, nervous about this and that. He says, okay, what exit do we go for, you know. And without even blinking an eye or missing my page in the magazine, I said, you know, we're going to go for the front one, because between us and the back one, there's about five fat people, you know. I had it ready to go, you know. You know, I said, take off your shoes and put both feet on the ground, Vince, because you can feel anything, you know. And so it's like, all right, you know, but I was just crazed about all this stuff. And I had, you know, my sponsor said, you know, God either is or he isn't. If he isn't, we're all dead anyway. You know, so I had to let God on the plane before me. And there's always a seat in first class for my God to sit, you know. And I had to learn how to take God with me. Because up until then, God had been Beacon's moving van for me. I don't know if you have that moving company out here. But I had one of those sponsors that told me I was going to get drunk because I was joined at the hip with this man in my life. You know, and she said, he can't be your higher power. You better get your own or you're going to get drunk. So Beacon's moving van drove by as she was berating me in front of my newcomer friends that night. You know, I said, fine, Janet, Beacon's fine. That's my higher power. Look, Beacon's moving van. And she said, fine, as long as it's not you. You know, she didn't care. So I prayed to Beacon's for a long time. You know, it made sense. You know, I just... If you're new, you'll understand this. You know, I kind of got moved all around the country like they do in the back of the van. And maybe there's a little knob off here and a little chip off there. And there's a scratch on that bureau, but it's always wrapped in those quilts. And it always gets to its destination. Well, that's how I felt about my life, that God had wrapped me in those quilts. And I was a little scarred and a little scratched, but I had made it to my destination. You know, so if you knew, you understand what I'm talking about. You old-timers are looking at me blank right now. I know that. But it made sense to me, you know. So I prayed to Beacon's for a long time. And I remember being in Texas 2 years ago, and I wasn't going to make my plane, you know. And this man was driving me, and the traffic was bad. And we could, you know, I wanted to say, go on the shoulder, for God's sakes. But, you know, he had more time than me, so I had to sit there and be nice and I'd be an example. And I had just spoken at their conference, so I can't really froth at the mouth here. And I know we're not going to make it, you know, and I had to make it. And right by us, inching right by us, comes a Beacon's moving van, you know. I took a big breath and just sighed and had this feeling like everything was going to be okay, you know. No matter where I am in life, you know, my son points them out today. Look, Mom, there's Beacon's. There's God, you know. have to be reminded because I get into me sometimes, you know, and I have to remember, thank God I'm not running the show. Thank God my God loves me much more than I love myself and that the plan is much bigger than my little designs. And I feel so comforted because I have a loving God today. My God is not punishing and out to get me. I have made amends to the Catholic Church. I get to sponsor a nun. It's really wonderful. I get to tell her to have faith. You know? I can walk in and out of a Catholic church and feel comfortable. It's just they've talked about peace and love today. I never heard that before. But my God is I found that I can take my God within me. You know, after I started working my steps, I began to start to feel that the great depth within. You know, that the book talks about. But I had to get there by chipping away at the plate glass that was sitting there, you know. About 11 months of sobriety, I'm going back and forth with my sobriety, but about 11 months of sobriety, I almost drank because I couldn't finish my inventory. I was so afraid of sharing that with another human being. I was doing the fifth step in the head, and I would sit down and I would try to write it, and I would get so panicked because I couldn't remember where I was when and who I was with, and it was all such a jumble of mess. And I couldn't finish my inventory, and I started to hear people talk about their slip, and they were so glad they went and had their slip because they learned this and they learned that. And I started to have stinking thinking again. And I'm not talking to anybody about it, but I'm setting up my slip in my head. You know, there's no slip. It was a setup. And I was getting ready to go out the door. I got a credit card in the mail. And I thought, this is it. God wants me to go. You know, I ended up at the airport and I called my sponsor and I said, I'm only going off for a little while. I'm going to go have my slip before I have my year and I'm committed forever. You know, I'm going to go have my slip and I'll be back. And she said, fine, Sharon, go. Be like my friend Stella. She was a long, raven-haired beauty. And she went out at 11 months because she wouldn't finish her inventory either. And she burned up in a bed. Well, he kind of dropped the phone, you know. It's like, take all the fun out of my slip here. You know, all I can think about being burned up in a bed, you know. And sponsors have done that for me over the time frame when I've come to crisis. They've said something to me that's pulled me back in because I've made one more phone call. Don't leave before the miracle happens. I was so mad at her that night that I went and bought a notebook and sat in the coffee shop at the airport and wrote. I was so mad the anger just took over and there was no fear there, you know. I was so mad the first couple of years I was here, I let that anger work for me. It was a wonderful motivator. You know, I had the cleanest house on the block. You know, now you come into my house, you cook out, she's serene. Look at it, you know. No anger left anymore. But I got through that. I took my fifth step. When I took my cake at the podium, I felt like I deserved it. For the first time in my life, I didn't run away from something that was very, very hard for me to do. And I felt just a touch. Just a couple of big drops of worth in my well. And I felt like I deserved my first birthday cake. And I have, over the years, worked on myself. I have fallen in and out of judgment. My defects come and they go. I'll tell you, I just thought I didn't have any for a while because years were rubbing off on me. I got married. You know, they were all his. He had to work on his. My dad came to the wedding. He, my three sisters and my mother came out to California, and we had an AA wedding. You know, we had two ex-Catholics being married by a Baptist minister with a day at a time till death do you part was put in there. Day at a time till death do you part. We had Amazing Grace sung. I wore my grandmother's wedding dress. We had ham sandwiches and a newly sober rock and roll band. And we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun. And at the end of the day, my father looked at me and he said, Sharon, look at your life today. You got it made. And I thought when my dad would give me his approval that the floor would just shake, that the angels would sing, you know, that it would make the major difference in my life and I would have this spiritual experience and be able to walk on. But what happened was when my dad gave his approval, my head and my heart went, yeah, you're right, Dad, I got it made, because I knew I was on the right track. I knew I belonged to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that I fit here, and I knew that the steps were here to give me hope. When I could work them, they gave me hope. And I thought, yeah, you're right, Dad. And about 5 years of sobriety, we had some marital problems, and we worked through them. I went to Al-Anon. I thought to release meant to reject. I had no idea what it meant. He became a punk rocker. He stopped going to meetings. I'm wearing the white hat. He's wearing the black hat. That's when I would wake up in the morning to the tunes of the Dead Kennedys and Fear, and he was just kind of out there. He was doing flotation tanks and just going to a club. I went to a club with him. I tried, you know. I spiked up my hair. It was the Cramps concert, a group called the Cramps. So I made a Midol shirt, you know, and went out there. we're all sober going out to this punk rock concert, you know, and they're out there slamming each other around. They do this slam dancing, you know, and I catch myself by the wall like this. Jesus Christ, I've done all this already. I don't have to do this anymore, you know. I just thought, uh-uh, you know, so I went to Al-Anon, you know. I quit putting his albums in the oven and turning it on, you know, because I'd have to tell on myself and buy him new albums, you know, and I just kept going with my program, and eventually I walked into my Al-Anon meeting one night, and there he was, sitting in my meeting, learning to release me, and we became friends again. We started to backpack, and we went up in the High Sierras. We went up to, it was Lake Florence and Florence Peak and the Snake River and a lot of that up there, and we did a lot of backpacking and became friends and survivalists together up there in the woods, and it rained for like 5 days, and we had to keep all the equipment dry, and I got pregnant. I didn't know that I wanted to do that, and I didn't know I could do that, and our marriage got really good again, and June 23rd, 1984, my son was born with all his fingers and all his toes, and I knew there was a God. I took hundreds and hundreds of hits of LSD. I abused myself with drugs and alcohol, and my son is definitely through me. He is not of me. He's God's kid. I just get to be his mom for a while. He tells me things now like he's glad he picked me for his mom. He's really glad he picked me. But you were there. You were there when he was born, Angie. You were there through the good times in my life, and you've been there through the bad times in my life. And after my son was a year and a half old, in January of 86, my husband left. And I was a housewife and a mother and comfortable and happy and sponsoring a lot of people. And Clancy had become my sponsor, and because my sponsor of 21 years, I got off a plane with 21 days, and I had to get a new sponsor. And I chose Clancy because I had watched him the whole time I had been sober. And he is one of those people that carries the torch of Alcoholics Anonymous high. He is out there doing it. He is not talking it. He is walking it. And he is 33 years sober and still experiencing the miracles and the hope and the life of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope to God, a day at a time when I'm 33 years sober, I can still experience the spark I feel today. That is something that is magical, and I hope it never goes out. And he became my sponsor, and when my husband left, I was in pain, deep, deep pain. And then I found out there was another woman involved, and then I felt betrayed. And, oh, my God, I put on the victim cloak again because I didn't know who knew and who wasn't telling me. And I sat and judged all of you, and I would circle my little wagons tight. Nobody got custody of the meetings, and he'd circle his little wagons tight, and nobody was speaking, and it was just terrible. And I went out and hired this lawyer who charged a lot of money to fight over record albums. You know, that's all we did was fight over record albums. And I didn't let him see his son, but I didn't drag Wesley through it, and I wanted to lay in bed, and my son would kind of shake me and tell me the phone was ringing, and he was, you know, he was a year and a half old. He was a year and a half to 2.5 years old during that time frame, and he doesn't ever remember his father living there, which is a blessing, and he doesn't remember too much about that other than he had those night tremors, and he would be up till 4 and 5 in the morning with those night tremors, and I just couldn't go out and find a job because I had no worth, and I just had given up on life, you know, but I kept saying yes to my AA requests. I kept saying yes when you asked me to do something, and I just sat there with just a tight jaw and judgment the whole time, but I kept showing up, and you didn't let me lie in my bed and die. You came and you got me and took me on interviews. You came and you got me and took me to meetings. You took me to movies. You fed me. You took care of me. You didn't give up on me. And I went and, you know, one thing I did was I knew that I had to stay physical because there was so much anger inside of me and so much hurt. And I found out that his new beau was playing on this softball team. So I went and re-upped with a softball team that played her softball team. And Jill was a left-handed hitter, so I tried out for second base, and I got that position. And when our teams played each other, there was one moment in Oxnard that not one of her balls got by me. She hit me in the face. She hit me. I put my leg out there and stopped one. You know, I dove in the dirt and stopped one. And at the end of that inning, her team stood up and gave me a standing O. It was just like, I was motivated. That's all I can say. You know? And it was a real painful time, and nobody talked to each other, and it was real painful. And my sponsor said, okay, Sharon, you got to quit looking at what they're doing and start looking at what you're doing. And that was the night he caught me with two hot cups of black coffee walking across the room to see how spiritual they were. And he happened to be in town that Saturday night, and he happened to see where I was off to. He saw where my eyes were burning. And he stopped me and took the coffee out of my hands and looked me in the eyes. He said, Sharon, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace so you can be an example for others. You know, because I sponsor people. I had been in that group for almost 11 years, and he didn't want to see me fall on my face. And he demanded that I walk through that with dignity and grace. I started working my inventory again on me. I started working the steps again and start looking at me. What was my share in it? What was my fault in it? And I hung up the victim garb. I finally walked into some new choices when I could hang up the victim garb. And it was 1 year and 1 month and 14 days later, I was sitting in that Catholic church waiting for the nun I sponsor. We were going to go to dinner. And I felt the healing. I just had been so far removed from that wholeness within me for so long that it was a spiritual experience when I got filled up again. And I was able to walk through the next door of my life. And I realized later on that I was just in a hallway. I thought I was thrown out in the woods and nobody cared about me anymore. Poor me. And what I was just in the hallway. You know, in this room of life, this house of life, there's a lot of rooms. And there's a lot of door closing and a lot of door opening. And, I drank tequila and rode Harleys because it was instant. You know, you start a Harley, it's an instant sound, an instant feeling. You drink some tequila, it's instant, you know. I like instant. And in Alcoholics Anonymous and living life and staying sober, there's not that many door closing, door openings all within a moment. It just doesn't happen that way, you know. You have to kind of grow and experience and be able to appreciate and be ready for the next door. And I'm not a patient person, but I have acquired patience here because of my experience, because what has happened to me. And then I could see I was not in the hallway alone, that all of you are in the hallway with me. You know, that there's a lot of people that are going through tough times, you know. But when I get into me, mine, and my little plans, there I am with my blinders on. I can't see you sitting next to me in the hallway. So I have learned how to enjoy the hallways. I've learned how to try to enjoy my growth, because you're going to go through them anyway. What are you going to do, go lay down in front of a bus, you know? Grow, you know? None of us wake up in the morning unless you're really sick and go, gee, I think I'll grow today. I mean, I think I'll hurt, work some steps and grow, you know? It doesn't happen that way. Life kind of throws you in there, and I have a loving God that moves me along, even when I don't want to move along. Always to something better, always. And the beauty is I get to watch you walk through the next door. Even if it's not, you know, even if it's not me, I get to watch you do it, and it gives me hope because I know it's my turn. My turn is coming, that the door will open. And that door opened for me in that February of that year, 1987, and my life changed totally, totally. I went out and got a job, a real job. I put together a real resume. I turned myself over to somebody, and they were my job sponsor, and they showed me how to get this job. And I walked into a large law firm in Los Angeles, and I got a job. I figured that's where the money is. I paid this attorney all this money. I'm going to go see what they're going to offer me, you know. So I walked into this job 4.5 years ago, and I was just promoted this last week. They say, good morning, how are you? And I don't tell these Harvard graduates how I am, really. I say, I'm fine, thank you, how are you? You know, they get the end result of me, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, working the steps and working my steps when nobody's looking. You know, nobody out there knows anything about me. I suit up and show up and do a great job. I'm a hard worker, and I get along well with people because I work my program when nobody's looking. And it has made my life, that area has turned into a profession for me. I never thought I would do what I'm doing when I grow up, but I'm doing it. And I'm able to send my son to a private Catholic school. He needs discipline and love just like me. And he got kicked out of his kindergarten, and he was hiding in the parking lot with other children. It wasn't so bad when he was doing it alone, but when he took the other children with him, it was a problem. So I had some problems with him, and I had to work with my son and start looking at him from his life from his level. I had to start doing a lot more reading to him. I had to spend some time with him on his level, play on the swing sets, and to be with him. And it made a major difference in his life. And he is doing his flourishing in this school. He won the reading rally last year. He thinks it's not cool. I shouldn't tell very many people about that. You know, it's more cool that he's had 2 soccer games this year and scored a soccer goal in each game. He thinks that's cool. But he won this reading rally, and the principal of the school, who's one of us, got to give him an award. And I was proud. And it was the last week of school I got to hear this story within hours of it happening. They were reading A.A. Milne in school, which is Winnie the Pooh, and so the teacher was reading who the author was, and before she even got started with the book, my son's hand shoots up, you know? A.A., I know A.A., my mommy's in A.A., you know? So she goes to meetings, she speaks at meetings, mine know A.A., and it was like, oh, no. So I got a call from the principal's office about this, and it was all very fine. You know, the teacher thought it was humorous, and I noticed that the first graders looked at me funny for a little while, you know? They weren't quite sure that's Wesley's mom, they'd say, But my son is really the apple of my eye, and he is God's kid, and I just get to have the privilege of being his mom, and I take that very seriously. His dad and his now ex-wife, my ex-step-wife, Jill, they had a baby, so he's got a half-brother, and we're all friendly today. Everybody's friendly today. I caught myself over at their son's first birthday party. I was dishing out cake, helping ice cream, taking pictures. I'd hold their kid, they'd take a picture. They'd hold my kid, we'd take a picture. We'd all get together and take a picture. It was just like this big extended family. And only in Alcoholics Anonymous and only with working a program. Only with working a program. And we all are in AA and nobody had to get drunk. Nobody had to get drunk. And he'd left her about 9 months ago. And guess who was the example of walking through it with dignity and grace for her? You never know. But we're all fine. And my ex has got to work through. There's some things that he's working through finally so that he can have a complete whole life. And he's a good dad to my son. And I got to walk into a new relationship with a man who's got almost 9 years of sobriety. I read something the other day. It said, a mate is there to help you find God. And I really respect that because he's not there to do something for me. It's what I can be of service to be in his life, what I can do for him. We don't live together. We've been going out a long time. We've been working towards a lot of things in our life. I think it's real important for me to be a mother to my son and to be an example of what I believe is right for my son. But the three of us get along well on the weekends, and we have a good time when we're together. Casey has a lot of dignity as a man, and I respect and love him, and I just never thought I would feel that. He's fun, too. He makes me laugh. And I'll tell you, I couldn't laugh for a long time here. I remember people would talk about dead dogs, and I would be the only one in the room snorting and chortling and laughing, you know. And it seemed so inappropriate, my laughter always did. And I'm a hard laugh, you know. But as time has gone on, I found myself laughing, and I found myself smiling, because there's something inside of me called the Spirit of God that I just can't hide anymore. Thank God. Thank God that it just has to come out. And it's only because Alcoholics Anonymous, my father and I have walked into a new relationship. My sponsor, when I was 5 years sober, Ginny, had me make financial amends to my dad. And she told me that she didn't care if he needed it or not to call him up and ask him how much I owed him. So I did, very begrudgingly. And he had a figure right there, you know. He had been out here and had bought the big book, and I know he's a reader and he read it. So he probably sat there and there was I could just imagine a calculator tape sitting there. If Sharon calls, give her this figure, you know. And so I was a little resentful about that, and I thought it was a little high. So I called Jenny back and I told her what I felt. And she said, that's fine, but we don't care how you feel. But we care that you're working the amends step of Alcoholics Anonymous. So call him back in 2 days and let's talk about what you can afford. So we talked about that, and I thought, good, in 2 days I'll call him back. And he'll remember I didn't go to Europe like the rest of the children. I paid for most of my own wedding. He paid for theirs. I didn't finish college. He never finished paying for my college. I thought he'd remember all that. He didn't buy me a car. I took him. He didn't buy him, you know. But when I called him back in 2 days, he accepted my terms. So I called her back and I said, okay, he accepted. And she said, fine, then on the first of every month, you make out your envelopes and you put them where you can see them because you are an example of working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You are not late with that check. You send it to him. And I said, okay. She said, oh, by the way, put a little note about your life, a little newsy note about your life and what you're doing. And I told her, I said, he doesn't care. She said, I don't care. These sponsors, they wait for you to kind of be in a vulnerable part, and then they just kind of push, you know. Thank God I've had sponsors louder than my own head that want more for me than I wanted for me. That between me and them are air. Between me and me is my head, you know. And I listened to her, and I did it anyway. And so I sent this check and this note off every month. And as I noticed, the notes were getting a little longer. I was telling him a little bit more about me. And it was not asking for anything back. It was being of service, being an example, working a step, putting it out, sending it to him. And it was about 2 years into it, I said, you know what? He doesn't need this. Why am I doing this? I can't afford it this month. She said, he's putting it into a trust fund for you, Sharon. Don't you know that? You can buy your Jaguar when this is all done. So, you know, I sent it off early for a couple of months. Smart sponsors, very smart sponsors. And it was Christmas time, and I was married then, and it was about 3 years down the road. I was about 8 years sober, and it was right around Christmas. It was between Christmas and New Year's, and my husband said, your dad's on the phone. And, my first thought was somebody died. And what my dad said was, happy holidays, Sharon. You don't have to send me any more checks. That the debt is free and clear, but don't stop sending me your notes. And it was like two little Christmas elves cut the chips off my shoulders.
And since then, I've been able to walk into a new relationship with my dad. I get to be his little girl. I get to be his friend. I get to hang with him when I'm with him. I respect him, and I love him, and I find out I'm a lot like him. And I admire that, so that's a plus for me today. I am pleased to be able to sponsor people and work with people and to watch the light go on in the eyes. If you're new and you don't feel like being here and you hurt like hell, I understand and good. You know, I hope you hurt. Because I didn't waltz in here because I wanted to change my whole life. I just thought maybe you could take care of me a while until this stuff in Palm Springs was over and then I could feel better and go out on the road. And thank God I stayed long enough to hear the hope and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous by not drinking and using between meetings, by having a home group, by getting a sponsor, by working the steps, by being able to give it away, by having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, not because I sat in my room alone and read the big book. As a result of working these steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have become a whole, complete human being, from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes. And, you know, I thought I was free before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, freedom was just another word for nothing left to lose. Janice sang it, and I lived it. You know, on the back of a Harley with a, you know, bottle of tequila in one hand and one finger in the other, you know. And I thought I was free as a bird, you know, and that this was my life and that it was just great. And I was suffering from the disease of alcoholism. I had no idea. And I came in here beaten and surrendered so the grace of God could take hold, so that you could show me freedom was working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Freedom was having a God of my own. Freedom was accepting and being able to give the love that we have here. Thank you so much, Lake Tahoe. I love you.